The first case on our calendar, 02-1377, State of Ohio versus Jeremy Cunningham. Ms. Prude Smithers.
Good morning. May it please the court, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Today I'm going to focus on the first proposition of law and Mr. Cunningham's brief regarding the trial court's failure to allow defense counsel to review the witness's statements for inconsistencies pursuant to Criminal Rule 16B1G. The use of the term shall in a statute or rule connotes the imposition of a mandatory obligation unless other language is included that evidences a clear and unequivocal intent to the contrary. This court has consistently required strict compliance with Ohio statutes when reviewing the procedures in capital cases. Those are direct quotes from this court's opinion in State versus Campbell, and those quotes direct how this court should deal with the issue presented by Mr. Cunningham today. During Jeremy Cunningham's capital trial, the trial court failed to allow defense counsel to review the witness statements for inconsistencies. And Ohio rule, Criminal Rule 16B1G is a criminal rule that directs courts regarding the appropriate procedure after a witness testifies, and that rule is clear. It specifically mandates an in-camera inspection by the trial court with defense counsel participating after the direct examination of a witness to determine whether there are any inconsistencies. Not only does Rule 16B1G require mandatory compliance, but this court, over two decades ago, in State versus Daniels, also interpreted this rule to mandate the court to allow defense counsel to personally inspect the witness statements for inconsistencies. The language of this court in Daniels demonstrates the importance of defense counsel's participation, for it is this court that noted that it is defense attorney's job to call to the court's attention any perceived inconsistencies. Highlighting these perceived inconsistencies is something that defense counsel is in the best position to do and is essential to the integrity of the adversarial system. Oftentimes, cross-examination is the sole presentation of a defense by the defendant. Daniels is a case that interprets the rule of 16B1G, but I started off this argument with a quote from State versus Campbell. And the reason I started off with that quote is because the error that occurred in State versus Campbell and also in State versus Green, which were two capital cases that this court reversed on the same day back in 2000, are so similar to the error that occurred in this case here. State versus Campbell, in State versus Campbell, this case reversed based on the failure of the trial court to allow those defendants right of allocution. In that case, and specifically, Campbell provides a great deal of guidance to this court on how to approach the violation of a mandatory rule. In Campbell, this court relied on the mandatory shall language of Criminal Rule 32, the right of allocution, and that Rule 32 states that before imposing the sentence, the court shall afford counsel and the defendant personally an opportunity to speak on behalf of the defendant. This court determined that the shall language in the rule imposed an affirmative requirement on the trial court to allow the defendant a right of allocution. Criminal Rule 16B1G imposes that same affirmative requirement.
Counsel, allocution, though, would be, it would seem, something vastly more important than defense counsel reviewing earlier statements. Now, there could be exceptions to that. What's the degree of information that defense counsel now has as to those prior statements? Are you still in the dark as to what they contain?
No, the trial court did follow the proper procedure of 16B1G in terms of placing those exhibits, placing the statements on the record. So those are part of this court's record and in front of this court today, and we have had an opportunity to review. In our brief and today, we maintain that this type of error is not subject to harmless error analysis. If you look at this court's opinion in State versus Daniels, this court said that the violation of Rule 16B1G was a reversible error per se. However, if this court does determine that this error is subject to harmless error review, after a review of those witness statements, There are several inconsistencies in some of the witnesses' statements, and the most significant were from Dwight Goodloe's. Mr. Goodloe was one of the victims of the shooting and the murder for which Cunningham was convicted. He was a direct witness to the crime and was able to provide compelling information to the jury. In fact, he was probably one of the most compelling witnesses in terms of the fact that he was, I think, the only witness of the shooting who was not seriously injured. So he was not immediately taken to the hospital. He, I think, had a minor abrasion to the head. However, review of Goodloe's statement taken immediately after the crime, as well as the statement taken a few days after the crime, demonstrate that his statement and trial testimony evolved in a manner that assisted the state. And what is important when looking at these inconsistencies is that most of the inconsistencies go to an aspect of the state's case that was weak. Mr. Goodloe testified regarding the order of the shooting, testifying that Jayla was shot by Cunningham. He testified that there was no signal between the co-defendants, Jackson and Cunningham. He testified that he did not see Cunningham shooting anyone else, but he believed Cunningham was still shooting because he saw his finger on the trigger and he saw smoke coming out of the gun and he saw Mr. Cunningham's head snap back. However, Goodloe's initial statements to the police, which were given when his recollection of events would have been best, lack many of these details to which he later testified. In Goodloe's first statement to the police, there was no reference to Cunningham shooting Jayla. There was no reference to seeing smoke coming from Cunningham's gun and to seeing Cunningham's head snap back. There was no reference to the absence of communication between Jackson and Cunningham. And when you look at the state's closing argument, you see why this additional information that was provided by Mr. Goodloe was important to the state's case. On page 1426, when explaining to the jury why prior calculation and design was proven, the prosecutor states, "Why was there virtually no communication, and still they acted as if on cue throughout this? It's because they had a plan and purpose to kill." On page 1447, the state, when arguing that Cunningham did shoot his gun, stated, "What does Dwight say? He says he shot Karan and his head came back. And what does Dwight say? He saw smoke coming out of the gun barrel. Well, Mr. Goodloe didn't say those things in his initial statements to the police, and defense counsel should have had the opportunity to review those statements and to question Mr. Goodloe about his evolving statement. This is particularly so given the fact that the physical evidence present at the time of the crime was contradicted many of the witnesses' testimony. A review of the record in this case also clearly establishes what the defense was in this case. The defense was not arguing that Jeremy Cunningham was not present and was not involved in this crime. They were arguing that they were contesting the amount of blame that should have been placed on Mr. Cunningham. They were arguing that he should have been convicted of a lesser included offense. And as support for this argument, defense counsel argued two things, that there was no prior calculation in design and that Cunningham's gun jammed so that he was unable to shoot the weapon. The two things that were contested by defense were the bits of additional information that Mr. Goodloe was able to provide the jury in his trial testimony. And defense counsel,
if they prevailed on all of that, does that elude the death penalty for him?
Yes, in this case it would have, because he would have, one of the essential elements to be found for him to have been found guilty of the aggravated murder with the death penalty specifications with the prior calculation and design element. And that was one of the major things that was being contested.
You've got two perpetrators there with guns firing away into a crowd of people. And if you can show this just spontaneously happened, you think that gets you off of prior calculation and design, and if you can show a jammed gun. So his bullets weren't the ones that killed the people, even though he was trying hard.
Well, I think there are two separate issues there. One, yes, someone who is complicit in the act can be found guilty of the principal offense. So, no, the fact that he...
And sentenced to death.
Yes. However...
Okay, that's the difficulty I'm having is with how that defense gets him out of the death penalty.
Well, it's primarily the defense regarding the prior calculation and design. That is one of the essential elements of the crime with which he was convicted of. And the jury had to find that he had prior calculation and design. And if it was a spontaneous action, this court has determined that in State versus Taylor is, I think, the principal case on prior calculation and design and the elements that are necessary for prior calculation and design. If the jury would have determined that Mr. Cunningham did not go in there with the intent to kill and that it was a spontaneous eruption of events, no, he would not have been eligible for the death penalty. He would have been eligible to be convicted of a serious crime and could have been punished severely for that, but he would not have been eligible for the death penalty. However, as I, going back to the beginning of the argument, one of the things that I'm arguing is in looking at—
But why wouldn't he be still eligible for death penalty for the killing of one or more persons? I mean, two people were killed here, not one.
Yes, but one of the elements of his aggravated murder conviction was the prior calculation design.
Yeah, but
that was one of the death penalty specifications.
But you could throw that one out and not accept that and still have the death penalty on the basis of killing of one or more persons.
Right, and yes, and technically under that specification, that does not ruin the elements of that specification. But I still believe that these two things that the defense attorneys were trying to present to the jury were important elements for the jury to consider. Certainly one of the, and the state obviously felt that it was important to consider. The state and the defense throughout the trial contested the fact. The state put on a lot of evidence about the fact of whether or not Mr. Cunningham could have shot this gun and whether in fact he ever did shoot the gun. And defense put on a lot of, or cross-examined several of the witnesses regarding the fact that the physical evidence contradicted that the physical evidence demonstrated that Mr. Cunningham never did shoot a gun. And I believe that that is important, and that does carry over to the penalty phase of this trial. This court has recognized in State versus Green that the fact that someone is not the principal offender in the murder is something that's important for a sentencer to consider for purposes of imposing the death penalty. And I believe it was important here. It was important during the trial phase.
Help me out again. I think most of those cases where somebody isn't the principal offender, they were maybe in on the planning but got cold feet and, you know, sort of withdrew from the crime scene. I can't recall one where, do I misunderstand the facts? Wasn't your client, I mean, he brought a gun to the scene, and I've been critical of some of this court's decisions on prior calculation and design. I think it's too thin a thread. But this one somehow seems different. He brought a gun to the scene. It's they're there for purposes of doing a drug transaction or robbing people. He participated in the robbery, did he not?
Yes, and I believe that.
And you've got all these people crowded in the kitchen, and he's got a weapon, and he's pointing it and trying to fire it, right? I mean, you don't dispute that.
Well, there was testimony that the gun perhaps jammed, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's trying mightily to be one of the people that caused the deaths involved here. Whether, in fact, it was bullets from his gun or not, when two people are involved in something like that, I'm still having difficulty understanding how he gets off the hook when there's more than one person dies.
Well, I don't believe
what's the legal defense at that point? Say you can prove his gun jammed, but he's pointing it and trying hard, and two people die, as they did here.
Right.
What's the legal defense to the death, the absolute legal defense to the imposition of death? What is it?
Well, if he still does not meet all the elements of aggravated murder and the death penalty specifications.
What's the missing element?
The missing element is the prior calculation and design. He certainly could have been found guilty of the murder of those individuals there because he was present and participating, regardless of the fact of whether he shot the gun. he still can be found complicit. However, if the essential element of prior calculation and design is missing, he is not eligible for the death penalty. And I don't believe that the facts of this case demonstrate that there was prior calculation and design. Someone can go to a crime with a gun, a crime scene with a gun, with the intent of just robbing and keeping people at bay. And that's what the testimony showed here, was that he was holding people off in the kitchen while the co-defendant was up robbing someone else. There was no evidence to indicate that there was prior calculation and design in that. What the evidence shows is that there was an eruption of events and shooting occurred. That does not make him technically eligible for the death penalty. And as to your first question,
Counsel,
regarding
even in light of the multiple deaths, you're saying that will still, the death penalty will be off the table. As a willing participant in a scheme, even if you say that things went awry and there was a spontaneous eruption, even though up to that point you're conceding that they all had orchestrated roles to play here, and then you have unarmed victims in a kitchen, huddled on the floor, and executed. And you're saying that taking away the concept of prior calculation design, the death penalty will off the table for your client?
Well, it is not absolutely off of the table.
It's not off the table at all.
Off of the set of those facts. But I think that what is important here is the fact that defense counsel was not able to present its defense through the cross-examination of witnesses. We don't know what the jury would have done with those inconsistencies in Mr. Goodloe's statements. And holding this court to what you have said in Campbell, you have said if there is shall language in a criminal rule, you are not just conferring a right on the defendant. You are making an affirmative obligation to that trial court to comply with those rules.
Well, counsel, let me go back to the statements that you're claiming were labeled as inconsistent in this. In fact, they're not necessarily inconsistent. My understanding is they were further detailed. The testimony given at trial represented, in essence, a more detailed analysis of what happened, as opposed to the original statements given to police in the immediate aftermath of the shootings. Is that correct?
Yes.
So it's not truly inconsistencies we're dealing with. We're dealing with maybe facts that were not elicited from witnesses in the immediate aftermath of the trauma that were later elicited at trial based on admittedly different circumstances and questioning by the prosecutor and then cross-examination by the defense attorney. Is that correct?
Perhaps you're dealing with an evolving story and defense counsel should have had an opportunity to ask him about that. Perhaps he did have an explanation. Perhaps it was the explanation that you just gave. But defense counsel should have had the opportunity to question him about that evolving story.
Well, I just want to be clear that when you're labeling inconsistencies, to me, inconsistencies mean, inconsistencies in material facts here, identification, that sort of thing. And we're not really dealing with inconsistencies. We're dealing with an increase in details.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
In Daniels, this court ruled that the failure to comply with 16B1G was a reversible error per se. Compliance with 16B1G should not be discretionary. The rule requires strict compliance to properly afford a defendant, and no less a capital defendant, with the right to present a complete defense and rights of due process and confrontation. And courts have reversed on this issue. In fact, the Third Appellate District reversed the Allen County Court of Common Pleas for failing to allow defense counsel to review witness statements. The court and the Third Appellate District in that case reversed the case without any further analysis. They did not perform a harmless error analysis. The fact, pursuant to Daniels, that defense counsel was not able to review the witness statements for inconsistencies alone resulted in the reversal of that case. Following this court's holding in Daniels, this court should reverse Cunningham's conviction for the trial court's failure. The state argued in its brief that Mr. Cunningham has waived this issue because defense counsel did not object to the trial court's erroneous ruling. And in Campbell, this court rejected that same argument advanced by the state. In rejecting the state's argument, this court focused on the mandatory language of that statute and found that in the context of that mandatory language, the rule was not merely giving the defendant a right, but was imposing an affirmative requirement on the trial court. The same is true in this case. The affirmative language in 16b1g, as well as in State versus Daniels, does not merely to give the defense the right to review witness statements for inconsistencies, but it also imposes an affirmative requirement on the trial court to allow defense counsel to review the witness statements for inconsistencies.
But these really weren't statements of a witness, were they? Weren't these contained in police reports?
Yes, I believe that the one was contained within a police report. The other one...
Well, are you asking us to make an extension then that a witness statement is now going to be anything that's contained in a police report under 16b1g? Is that what the rule of law would be if we adopt what you're asking us here this morning?
Well, what we have here is what the trial court found that these were statements.
Well, wait a minute. The court didn't do that. The rule says that the trial court shall determine if there are inconsistencies. And as I understand it, in some witnesses, the court did find inconsistencies. But with respect to these witnesses, it did not.
That's correct.
And your argument is that the court should have found further inconsistencies.
Well, no. My argument is that when the court reviewed the statements for inconsistencies,
yes,
defense counsel should have been present and participating, according
well,
to this
more than that, the question, the predicate question to me, it seems, is whether or not these are in fact witness statements or whether this is part of a police report that was filed in which the police account, as opposed to a separate statement given by a witness, is subject to the 16B1 disclosure. Would you address that issue for me, please?
Well, I believe just by looking at the record in this case that these are witness statements according to 16B1G. That is what the court found. The court said we're going to review these witness statements under 16B1G. There was no contest of the fact or objection to the fact that these were witness statements. The state didn't say that. The courts didn't argue that. The court reviewed them under 16B1G. They found that they were statements, and they reviewed them under that purpose. The problem here is that they didn't fully comply with the requirements of 16B1G. I don't believe that is an issue in this case. And looking back again on Campbell is really instructive to this court on the harmless error analysis that you perform when there is a mandatory rule involved. In Campbell, the trial court never had an opportunity to hear Campbell's personal appeal for his life, but the court did hear his videotaped confession and testimony from a psychologist who repeated facts of Campbell's personal plea. Alva Campbell had a previous murder conviction. He had been currently under arrest for robbery when he escaped, and during his escape, he murdered a young man who was at the courthouse to pay a traffic fine. He was arrested shortly after the murder and was caught by the police. This court determined that the failure of the trial court to allow Alva Campbell, to not permit Alva Campbell his right of allocution, was not harmless error. In other words, this court would not say that Campbell's sentence was not affected by the failure to hear Mr. Campbell's statements, despite the fact of the strong evidence of his guilt and of the multiple aggravating circumstances in the case. And if that's true, then the failure of the trial court to permit defense counsel to review witness statements in Cunningham's case was also not harmless. This was unquestionably a horrible crime. Innocent people and children were murdered and were subject to unimaginable suffering. There can be no argument against that. This is the type of crime that inflames the passion of the community and the jury that serves in that community. And it is exactly with this type of case that the trial court needs to exercise the greatest of caution to ensure that the trial is conducted properly. Trial courts should be vigorously and absolutely held to the duty to protect the integrity of the adversarial system, and this includes allowing defense counsel to represent the interest of a client by testing the consistency of a witness's statements. Trial courts are not in the best position to review for inconsistencies because it requires taking the trial courts out of the role of a neutral party and placing the court in the role of advocate. And appellate courts also should not be performing an after-the-fact review because we end up with what we have here, with two different versions of what could have happened, what may have happened, what should have happened. Trial court should do it right the first time. This information should be introduced at trial so that the jury can adequately weigh the facts and reach a determination. It is the jury's role, not our role, to determine the importance and materiality of inconsistencies. Many trial courts strictly follow the rule of 16b1g, as they should. However, the Allen County Court of Common Pleas has more than once ignored the requirements of this court in Criminal Rule 16b1g. We are asking this court to hold trial courts accountable to the firm language of both 16b1g and the rule pronounced over 20 years ago in Daniels by reversing Cunningham's conviction and remanding for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pruitt Smithers. Ms. Gutman.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jana Gutman. I'm appearing today on behalf of the state of Ohio. Prior to launching into my argument, there is one matter that I'd like to perhaps clear up for the court. That relates to the prior calculation and design topic that came up during the appellant's argument. The state would submit that prior calculation and design is not an issue in this case. It's not an element of the aggravated murder itself with which the defendant was charged. There were two death specs on the indictment, one being the A7 that reiterates the felony ag murder elements with prior calculation and design, the second being the A5 spec that the defendant engaged in a course of conduct involving the purposeful killing of two or more, or attempt to kill, for that matter, of two or more people. He was found guilty of both of those death specs, but prior to the sentencing phase, the trial court merged them. Only the course of conduct involving the purpose to kill or attempt to kill two or more people is the one that went to the jury in the sentencing. They never decided anything about prior calculation and design when they were weighing the aggravating circumstance against the mitigating factors, and I just think that that's important for the way that counsel's argument was going in the appellant's argument, because the prior calculation and design was not before the jury in the least when they were making the determination about the death penalty. And so, as I noted when I started out, the state would submit that that is not at issue in the determination of this appeal. Now, the defendant appellant in this case has raised 13 propositions of law. I certainly wouldn't have the time this morning to address each one thoroughly. Accordingly, I'd like to focus my argument in this case on issues which are perhaps a bit more unique or specific to this case. I would intend to run through these in the order raised, unless the court already has specific questions about something that they'd like me to address. Very well. In the first proposition of law, of course, at issue is the trial court's handling of the 16B1G review of witness statements. The state does not quibble that in 1982 in State v. Daniels, this court determined that criminal 16B1G requires that defense counsel be provided a copy of the statement during that review for inconsistencies. In this case, the trial court, it appears from the record, did alone review the statements. Six motions were made, or I guess I should say motions were made regarding six different witnesses. On three of those occasions, the trial court did find that certain inconsistencies existed and granted or gave those statements to counsel for the defense. In three instances, the trial court found no inconsistencies and did not provide the statements. Those statements were preserved and are in the record before this court. Now, of course, the crux of the issue here is whether this is reversible error. The defendant, based upon a very strict and literal interpretation of the Daniels case, argues that it is. The state, of course, submits that Daniels very clearly contemplates the application of a harmless error analysis under these circumstances. in a situation such as this where the statements at issue that were not provided to defense counsel do not contain material inconsistencies. As detailed in our brief, we suggested a careful reading of Daniels leads directly to that conclusion about harmless error. Courts of appeals throughout the state have reached that same determination since the Daniels decision was issued. Now, in the three witness statements that are at issue here, which, as noted, are in the record, a comparison of
counsel,
each. Yes, sir.
Would it be a case-by-case determination of whether or not it's harmless error?
That would be exactly the state's position. And
so it could be very harmful error as well.
I think it could be. Where I was going to go with my argument is I think ultimately what the court really needs to be looking for is actual prejudice. That could depend on what was in the statement. It could depend on whether there were inconsistencies. The state would suggest that it could even depend on how important was the witness. Was it a corroborating witness of a very minor detail in the case, or was it a key sole eyewitness that from which, you know, half of the elements were
well,
proven?
Well, here the witness was, in fact, important. I mean,
I'm sorry, sir?
The witness was, in fact, important. He's in the room. He's an eyewitness.
Yes, he was one of six surviving eyewitnesses. And I didn't mean to suggest that I view this specific witness as one that is unimportant. We urge the court, first of all, to conduct its own comparison of the statements that are in the record with the trial testimony of the witnesses that gave those statements. We believe that you will conclude that the prior statements contain no material inconsistencies.
I'm wondering, why did this even happen?
I can't answer that, sir. I don't know. I think it is somewhat relevant that defense counsel did not object as well. I'm certainly not trying to shift the burden. It's the trial court's responsibility under 16B1G or under any rule to, of course, adhere to the appropriate procedure. There was no objection made, though. This error was not called to the trial court's attention.
What was the prosecutor's role in all of this?
It's not very plain from the record. Each time a 16B1G motion was made, may we approach, it appears it was done at the bench. The trial court says, certainly, let me review these statements. The state apparently produced the statements for the court. And then, as noted, three different times the trial court says, well, there are some certain inconsistencies here. I'll grant you, you know, here, take the statement, go ahead and cross-examine. The three other times the trial court simply ruled, I don't find any inconsistencies upon review. Defense counsel says, thank you, sir. They step back and start cross-examination.
Okay. But the rule says defense counsel is supposed to be participating in that process.
That is correct, Your Honor. And this court made that perfectly plain over 20 years ago in State v. Daniels. The state
how
is
do we
not
get
that
message
that.
Down to trial courts who are making these reviews on a daily basis?
Your Honor, I don't know how to answer that question exactly. All I can really state is that, in my opinion, I think the record in this case reveals that the parties and the trial court were certainly doing the best they can to protect every right that the defendant was to be afforded. There's certainly nothing in the record that would lead this court to conclude that the trial court thought that the statements were to be provided and simply said, you know, forget about it, I'm not going to do this. It appears to be more of an ignorance of that particular aspect of the rule.
Does it make any difference that this was what a policeman had recorded in a police statement as opposed to a separate statement written out by a witness?
Your Honor, I think that it could. I did not raise that in my brief, but the point that you brought up, and there's quite a bit of case law on that too, that are we talking about a transcription or a self-written statement by a witness, or are we talking about a police report that is another person's synopsis of an interview or what a witness had to say? We don't know if that was a thorough interview. We don't know if the for instance, this witness was asked, is that everything you have to say? Is that everything you recall about what happened? I mean, there was nothing to suggest that it was supposed to be an entire account. And I think that that's part of the problem in making the review for inconsistencies, is that you're not talking about, say, prior testimony of the witness where everything was fleshed out. You're talking about a police officer's summary thereof of an interview that could have been a 5-minute interview or, you know, a 5-hour interview. And that is problematic. Excuse me. We would also suggest to this court that perhaps the Daniels decision itself needs to be reexamined, not so much the part regarding the procedure to be employed in doing the 16B1G review, but the holding, the reversible error per se holding itself. Worst case scenario, assume a prior statement that is inconsistent, that is not provided to defense counsel. Shouldn't we still require a finding of actual prejudice? That is, of course, a fundamental axiom of appellate review. There are very few instances where the law presumes prejudice, and those situations are typically blatant constitutional rights violations or the admission of some highly inflammatory, completely irrelevant evidence, to give a couple examples. It just seems, from the state's perspective, using general legal principles, that the effect of the denial of the statement should be examined, and that is why we suggest that perhaps the majority in the Daniels decision went a bit too far out on a limb in their holding, in not taking into account situations like the one I just suggested. But the bottom line in this case, we submit, are that while the trial court did not comply with the appropriate procedure, no error resulted, specifically because there are not inconsistencies in the three statements at issue. The defendant apparently concedes that, with the exception of one instance, and again, we urge you to compare Dwight Goodloe's prior statement with his trial testimony. It is completely consistent in every key way in terms of what happened, who did what, who shot, who had what gun, and the whole sequence of events that evening. For all those reasons, we would suggest that the first proposition of law should be overruled. In the second proposition of law, at issue is a jury instruction on credibility given in the guilt phase. The trial court gave the standard OGI instruction on credibility, including, however, two additional sentences that are at issue here. The standard of review, of course, is abuse of discretion, and this court must consider the effect of that instruction in the context of the overall charge. As we noted in our brief, that instruction was previously upheld in a 10th District Court of Appeals case that was subsequently, as a death penalty case, affirmed by this court. We would simply suggest, regarding that instruction, that the worst thing you can say about it is that it's unnecessary. It's certainly not incorrect. It does not misstate the law. On the facts of this case, the defendant's argument that the instruction deprived him of his only viable defense is an incredibly weak argument. There were no glaring inconsistencies among the testimony of all the witnesses as to what happened. In fact, the testimony was quite consistent. More importantly, the defendant's participation in these crimes was completely uncontested at trial, other than the defense attempting to maintain the defendant never actually fired a gun. And that argument would go, at best, to mitigation, and this was a guilt phase instruction. It was not repeated in the mitigation phase. For all of those reasons, we would suggest that no error, certainly not reversible error, resulted from the giving of that credibility instruction. In the third proposition of law, the defendant submits generally that the death penalty is appropriate. The main gist of the argument there goes back to a theme that runs throughout their entire argument, there's no evidence that the defendant ever shot his gun argument. As we went to great pains in our brief to point out, that argument by the defense completely ignores the testimony of every single surviving eyewitness that could remember the crime. There was one who suffered memory loss who could testify to nothing. Each and every one of those witnesses from the get-go in their prior statements, much less their trial testimony, testified that both men opened fire. They described the manner in which it was done, this defendant shooting from left to right, the other man shooting from right to left. We would suggest that given that evidence, along with ballistics evidence that at best is ambiguous when construed in context, that this court, in doing its independent review and doing its proportionality review, should conclude that the death penalty is more than appropriate. The issue of the defendant firing his firearm, as noted earlier, at best goes to some sort of mitigation. It's certainly not a direct defense. It's not an element of the death specification that was before the jury. It would be more of just a moral culpability or not argument that they made, saying his role was less. We would just urge the court to carefully consider the record. All of that is completely refuted by the testimony that was presented. It was quite clear cut that both of these men actively participated. The defendant had a knowing, voluntary role prior to it. It was pre-planned. He helped wipe down the gun and the ammunition. They knew full well when they got in there that there was a room, a house full of children and other people. In fact, the intended victim wasn't even home when they arrived. They could have left at any time and just aborted the plan, if you will. They followed through. As you know, this defendant held the women and children and one male adult at bay in the kitchen while they pled for their lives. And after the robbery was completed by the co-defendant upstairs, they then both opened fire on the entire group, ultimately killing two and severely injuring most of the others. We feel that those facts, which of course go directly to the death specification, the aggravating circumstance, completely outweigh any mitigating factors of the defendant's background and so forth in this case, and would ask the court to make that finding accordingly. In the fourth proposition of law, the defendant argues that the trial court impermissibly restricted questioning during voir dire regarding specifically mitigating factors. The law, of course, and the standard of review are well established. The state would simply submit that a review of the record will firmly establish to this court that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in that regard. The instances cited in the defendant's brief are taken out of context, out of the entire questioning in which those specific blurbs occurred. Each and every juror that was seated unequivocally indicated their willingness to give the defendant a fair trial, to consider all sentencing options, and to follow all applicable rules of law. And we would suggest, again, that the record does not support the fourth proposition of law raised by the defendant. The fifth proposition of law goes to pretrial publicity and whether the trial court should have granted a change of venue. This case is a little different from a lot of cases because they're arguing here that the court should actually presume prejudice from the pretrial publicity. The defendant would have you believe that Allen County citizens, in the months between the crimes themselves and the ultimate trials, heard of, talked of, thought of nothing else. Again, the record completely refutes this claim. Every single juror that was ultimately seated, specifically, they did indicate, yes, I remember hearing something about that. Yes, I think I did see it on the news back when it happened. None indicated that they had any particular knowledge of the facts. No one knew anybody that was involved in the case. They again, all readily agree that they did not know enough facts to have prejudged the case, and what facts they knew, if any, could be set aside. We would just suggest that the record does not come close to establishing a situation where prejudice should be presumed due to pretrial publicity, and that the trial court here did not abuse its discretion in failing to change venue. It was the overwhelming evidence against the defendant that convicted him in this case, not pretrial publicity. The sixth proposition of law is a challenge to the admission of autopsy and crime scene photos. We have thoroughly briefed this issue. The court is well aware of the law on it. And We would just suggest that a consideration of the photographs in comparison to the reason that they were admitted, once the record is consulted, that will lead this court to reject the defendant's claim in that proposition of law. The seventh proposition of law contains another jury instruction that was one that was given in the penalty phase, wherein the court instructed that the only evidence admitted in the first phase that is relevant to the aggravating circumstance and mitigating factors is to be considered in the penalty phase. The challenge here is that this instruction does not tell the jury what is relevant, does not give them the appropriate guidance. As noted in our brief, though, this court has previously on several occasions addressed this exact instruction. This court has determined that at best it's ambiguous, and in the cases that we cited in detail, the Jones case and the Coley case, this court found, as is the situation here, that when that instruction is viewed with the overall charge, the jury is appropriately instructed as to what they need to do in that penalty phase, what evidence they should consider. And I think it's also worth noting in this case, as in Jones, the defendant did not object to the instruction. And more importantly in this case, the aggravating circumstance that went to the jury was, again, that it was part of a course of conduct involving the purposeful killing or attempt to kill of two or more people, and that was the entire state's case here. Put another way, there is literally no evidence that was presented in the initial phase of the trial that would be irrelevant to the specification. There were not other instances. It was all one incident, and it was all one course of conduct. Again, while it was the evidence in the guilt phase, it would also be directly relevant to the specific aggravating circumstance that the jury was to consider.
But it is true that the only shell casings came from the automatic weapon. Isn't that so?
That's true, Your Honor. The testimony was unrefuted and uncontradicted by the defense, though, that the second weapon with which this defendant was armed was a revolver. Revolvers do not eject shell casings as semi-automatics do. Revolvers, when you shoot the bullet, now, of course, the bullet comes out, but the casing stays in the gun.
What about the pellets recovered? Were those identified?
Yes, there were. I can't recall if it was either five or six. One was a fragment. In terms of recovered bullets themselves, the five or perhaps six that were recovered were determined to be fired from a .380, which is a semi-automatic weapon. However, as we noted in our brief, there were either the five or six bullets or spent bullets recovered. However, the victims collectively suffered, I believe it was 14 wounds. Now, some of that, I think, is going to be accounted by through and through. We know that the two fatal wounds to the two children victims were through and through wounds. Also, as we noted in our brief, though, the state believes it's quite significant that we know there are at least three other bullets that were involved that, because of various circumstances, were not recovered and were not able to be tested and checked. And certainly no one knows if this defendant with his revolver started with a loaded gun. I mean, he may have only had two or three bullets. I mean, no one knows that. There was no testimony as to that, and he didn't take the stand to explain it one way or another. So we would suggest that when you look at the ballistics evidence, the lack of casings, you wouldn't expect to find from his gun. It doesn't work that way. The bullet evidence, well, yes, what's there was .380 semi-automatic ammo. However, it still doesn't add up completely. I mean, again, we clearly know that there were 14 wounds, and we don't have enough bullets at all to go around to account for all of those injuries. And all of that fails to take into account the uncontradicted eyewitness testimony that both men opened fire. Once the co-defendant shot Shane Lyles, the first victim, when he brought him downstairs in the back, then they both opened fire on the rest of the group. In the eighth and ninth propositions of law, the defendant raises prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective assistance of counsel, respectively. Again, we have thoroughly briefed and argued both of those in our written arguments. Unless the court has questions specifically, I will let those ride on our briefs. I did want to address the 10th proposition of law, where the trial court's written sentencing opinion is at issue. The defendant, I'll strike that, it's plain from this court's cases that when a capital defendant is convicted of more than one count of aggravated murder, that the trial court must assess the penalty for each count separately. We acknowledge that, and we're certainly not arguing about that. In this case, the trial court sentencing opinion did not specify that both counts were being considered individually as the trial court was reaching its sentencing conclusion. And as we note in our brief, the opinion may have been flawed in that sense. However, we submit that that does not amount to reversible error. Specifically, in State v. Mitz, that's a case we cited in our brief, this court specifically determined that the Supreme Court's ultimate independent review cures that exact kind of flaw in a sentencing opinion of the trial court. We would also note that this error was much more of a procedural error versus an actual substantive error. And by that I mean that the trial court's ultimate conclusion, its sentencing verdict, if you will, was legally accurate and correct. It was simply the expression of the analysis used that is flawed, not that ultimate conclusion. The facts of this case, we suggest, are also important here. While each count should have been weighed separately or expressed separately in the opinion, in this case, the factors that go to support the aggravating circumstance in each case are identical. It's not the situation where the circumstances surrounding, say, the first aggravated murder in a spree of some sort are totally different from the second aggravated murder or third or so forth. And there is absolutely no indication whatsoever that the trial court, in its opinion, used some sort of cumulative analysis to boost or bootstrap the aggravating circumstances to a point that they outweighed the mitigating factors. It's quite clear that the trial court felt that separately they did. It was simply expressed poorly. Again, State v. Mitz, this court's independent review, where, as we noted earlier, this court should reach the same conclusion, would cure any procedural flaw in the trial court's entry. The final three propositions of law are what I would categorize as standard death penalty challenges. I think that those may be summarily overruled by this court on the basis of well-established precedent. In summary, unless the court has any additional questions, I would just like to note something that many of this court's previous opinions set forth, and that is that a criminal defendant, even in a death penalty case, is not entitled to a perfect trial, is not entitled to an error-free trial. What he is entitled to is a fair trial, a just trial, a trial that can be relied upon as having produced an accurate, just result. That is exactly what happened here. This defendant did achieve and receive an entirely fair trial. The few errors that did occur, compared to the evidence and the facts of the case in general, can be and should be considered by this court to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The state presented absolutely overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt here and his complete participation in all aspects of these crimes. The aggravated circumstance also completely outweighs any mitigating factors. And for those reasons, on behalf of the people of the state of Ohio and on behalf of the two innocent children slaughtered brutally by this defendant, the state is requesting that this court affirm the judgment of conviction and sentence imposed by the trial court in all respects, including the sentences of death.
Thank you, Ms. Gutman. Ms. Prude-Smithers, you've saved about 4.5 minutes of your time.
I just wanted to address a few things, a few points that were made by the state. And one goes to the prior calculation and design element and the fact of its importance or the place of its importance in this trial. The jury had to determine prior calculation and design in order to even get to the sentencing, so it was important for the jury's consideration, despite the fact that it was later merged, in order to even get there, in order to even consider the death penalty, the jury had to consider prior calculation and design, and it was an important part of the case. If you review the state's closing arguments, much of the closing argument was spent trying to demonstrate why prior calculation and design was proven in this case. Trial courts have had over 20 years to get this right. Allen County has consistently gotten it wrong. And unlike the state stated, the witness's testimony here was not just a consistent story. The witness's statements were all over. And I'm certain that a lot of that stems from the fact that it was a very chaotic environment during the middle of the crime. But the fact is that one witness would say one thing. One witness said that Cunningham shot Jayla. Another witness didn't. Her father, who was holding her, did not state that. One witness said that they didn't say anything to each other. Another witness stated that they did say something to each other before they started shooting. There were inconsistencies, and the physical evidence contradicted much of the witness's testimony. And another thing I want to address to this court is why not being the shooter in this case was so important. And one of the things that this court should do in reviewing that is look at this court's opinion in State versus Green. In that case, Joseph Green and his co-defendant robbed a man and a woman right before Christmas. Both co-defendants had guns. A living witness, the man, testified that Joseph Green chased him down, shooting him multiple times. And when he fell to the ground, Joseph Green walked up to him from behind and shot him in the back of the head. This court determined that the fact that the defendant was not the principal offender in the murder of the woman was important to Joseph Green's case. And this court remanded his case. Joseph Green ended up with a sentence of life upon resentencing. Not being a principal offender can make the difference between life and death, even the worst of cases.
Counsel, in the case that you just cited, there was only one death, not multiple deaths, correct?
That is correct.
All right, and here we have the two deaths.
Yes, that is correct. But both cases did have bad facts, too. Not all criminal rules are mandatory, but this one is. And we can quibble over the harm and the extent of the harm in this case. But what this court really needs to decide today is if trial courts need to follow all mandatory rules. We don't see in front of this court, this court does not see any more cases where a defendant has been denied the right of allocution. And that's because this court made it clear in Campbell and in Green that trial courts had to follow that rule. This court should make it clear that trial courts need to follow 16B1G. Courts have had 20 years to get it right, and they need to get it right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Prudsmith. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.